Accession number 18022, Reel 5.
Come back, Reel 5.
The people that living in the towns and that, they were living in the same conditions as us, in places they'd knocked together themselves, and there were no windows, no roofs, and I don't suppose there was a sewage system. That was another thing. If you got into the country, each village in that, the villages, had a big pit, and they collected all the human sewage and they poured it in the pit and saved it. And then come the spring, they put it in a long barrel pulled by a bullock on a cart, and they put water with it, and they used to drag it to the rice field, and as they planted rice they used to put it a scoop of this fertiliser in, and that dried in as the spring progressed. The weather got warmer, it dried and it turned into a dust. So if you drove over the paddy fields and that, you threw up the engine threw up a cloud of dust, and you'd get it. They issued us with goggles to stop it getting in the corner of your eyes, and people used to tie bits of scarves on their mouths and that to try stop breathing in, but you couldn't stop it all, and you ended up with sores in your nose and ears and eyes and that, with the, you know, the dried dust and that. And the treatment was drop his trousers, bang so many units of penicillin, and that was supposed to cure it. That was, you know, and it has been known. I don't know anybody personally, but it has been known for people to walk into these pits, because in the winter it had a crust on top, and if it had a sprinkling of snow, it just looked like ordinary ground. And there has been one or two cases, although I don't know them personally, that they've actually walked into. The deepest I got into a paddy field, and it was over. I had small ammunition boots on, like these, and I got into just, you know, about that deep, and it was just raw sewage in that. I had to throw my boots away and throw my socks away, and I borrowed a pair of boots and just washed my feet as best I could, and, you know, put the socks on. Once you knew about these things, you used to be very, very wary then of where if you were going in a village, you would walk down the path. You wouldn't walk on the side, because you didn't know if it was a normal paddy field or it was one of these big honey pits. That was one thing. There were snakes as well. All kinds of snakes. There was quite a lot of wildlife. One time, the guy in charge of our crew was an Ulster man, a reservist that had come back, and his civilian occupation was a gamekeeper. And this was towards the autumn. A lot of the stuff had been left in the fields. It had been bagged but never harvested. And the bags had split, and there were pheasants galore. And I had an American rifle that I acquired while I was out there. And he used to borrow it and shoot pheasants. And he would clean them. And we had part of a stove, a cast iron stove that we carried with us. And we used to feed wood into it and make charcoal, and with a grill, a bit of a grill on top, and melt a tin of margarine and just keep pouring it on the pheasants and turning it over. And the outside used to be absolutely black, but when you peel that off, the skin inside was beautiful white. And he caught a deer while we were out there. He put a snare up down by the river, and he caught the deer, and we went to inspect it, and it were all trampled down, and the wire was there, and there was blood and everything round it, and eventually we found one of squadron tanks had it hung on their gun barrel. The guy had butchered it. They had a guy that was a butcher, and he'd gutted it, skinned it, and that, so he had to share his venison with the squadron. They said there was bears there, but I never saw any bears. But there were snakes. I wasn't very keen on snakes. If I saw a snake, I either got a shovel and cut its head off with a shovel, or flattened it with a shovel, or if it were a bigger one, there's some quite big ones, I used to shoot it. I'm terrified of snakes. Not now, but at that time I was terrified of snakes. Towards the back end of November, we were in this particular place, and we got these Korean guys to dig us a big hole in the ground. And for 10 days, four of us lived in a hole in the ground. And it was basically like a big trench, and it was wide enough to put four sleeping bags, and you could walk in. And they'd cut steps down for us. It was probably about 8 foot, well, 6-7 foot deep. You could barely stand in it. And we'd roofed it with logs and put the tarpaulins on top. And we slept in there. And we used to make petrol stoves out of 5 gallon drums and cigarette tins. And used to feed them from a drip feed outside. But if you weren't careful, and the drip got faster and faster, the thing used to blow up like, and you know, you ended up inflamed, and one or two hurt with these petrol stoves, but it was the only way you could keep warm when you were in. At that time we were fairly static, and it were like a job. You got up in the morning, you cooked your breakfast, and you hung around till somebody said, this so-and-so shed a track. So you went out to him, did whatever you had to do, come back, and you waited again, had your dinner. There were nowhere around, no buildings or no villages or anything around. That particular time, the nearest Americans invited us to go and see Bob Hope, a concert party. But there was a threat of a Chinese attack that night. So I was taken off the ARV crew, and I spent the night where I should have been watching Bob Hope, sat in an armoured car with 2 pound of shells on me, knee waiting for Chinese coming, and they never came. We had other concert parties that came out. With Jack Warner, he came out. Elsie and Doris Waters, they came out. Paula Marshall and Brian Reese, they came out. There was others came out, but those were the only ones that I saw. And Elsie and Doris Waters, they used to be, I think they were Jack Warner's sisters. And they were comedians. That used to be on the radio and do the music halls, you know, the tour of the music halls, and they were brilliant. They were ever so dirty minded, and the guys lapped it up. And they cracked jokes like, you know, soldiers crack jokes, dirty jokes, and that, and their concert party went down a bomb. Like anything else, there would be one or two disappointed, but the majority of the guys thought they were brilliant. Can't think of much more.
I got in front of me a BBC cassette entitled The War in Korea, recordings from the BBC Sound Archives, and in the blurb on the cover there's a quote from a journalist called James Cameron, who says, it quotes, "There never was a war like this one for bitterness and savagery." What do you think to that quote?
Yeah, I think it's it's quite a genuine quote. the casualty list for Korea was horrendous. In fact, the numbers are never actually known, the number of civilians that were killed. But there were more, taking the United Nations as a whole, as well as the Americans and that, because they stood the biggest part of the casualties, did the Americans and South Koreans, because there was more of them there. But they lost more in the Americans lost more, I believe, in 3 years than they did in Vietnam in the 10 years that Vietnam was going on. I mean, there were bodies all over. You'd go swimming in a river, and you would, you know, swim around, and that next thing, a body would come floating down the river, blackened, blown up, and that. So you didn't know whether it was Chinese, English, Korean, or anything like that. We stayed while we were in reserve. We were in this. Well, it had been a village, but there were nothing left of it. But they had a well in the centre of the village had been a well, you know, like a dry stone well built. And that was in the summer when the beer ration used to come up. So to keep it cool, we used to put it in a bag, like a kit bag, lower it into the well to keep it cool, and they came disconnected from the rope. So one guy went down the well to get the bag up, and there were two Chinese bodies stuck in it, and we'd been drinking the beer out of it. As I say, the refugees suffered as much through the weather as we did. I don't know about so much about the fighting. I mean, how many was killed that way? But apparently, at that time, at one time, there was a problem with the guerrilla being mixed up among the refugees, and the Korean people are cruel. If you speak to Japanese ex-prisoners of war, Japanese, they will tell you often the Koreans that was the guards was crueler than the Japanese themselves. They are a cruel people. I'm telling you, while I was looking after these prisoners of war, they were building this dry stone wall, and I was smoking, and at that time you had that many cigarettes, you used to, you know, throw half a cigarette away, and I threw the half cigarette away, and one of the prisoners picked it up, and the South Korean guard came over, and no more to do that kicked him straight in private parts and put him down like that for picking a cigarette butt up. So I got hold of the South Korean, shoved him up against the wall, and took me 38 out and shoved it up his nose and shook my head, and I think he gathered what I meant. Don't do it again. But they were cruel like that. They weren't cruel like that to us, but to their own people they were cruel. I probably shouldn't say it, but we used to basically treat them as with contempt, probably through our ignorance as much as anything. I mean, you couldn't even talk to the kiddies because there were refugee kiddies all over. And while if you were going up or down on the flat cars, as soon as a train stopped, there would kiddies appear, you know, begging for food and that. I remember once, nearly all used to carry a tin opener around the neck on a piece of string. And they were all, you know, they were begging like for food and that. And I threw this kiddie a tin of pom, you know, mashed potato powder. And he opened it up and he poured it on the floor and he stood there with tears streaming down his face. Because I don't know why, but he must have thought I'd thrown him a tin of rubbish. But he didn't know what the potato powder was for. You know, that you put water and mixed it up and then you could eat it. And that was the total lack of communication between us.
So he just cast it away?
He just threw it away, yeah. Yeah. But I don't know, they probably operate in gangs and share stuff with one another. I don't really know. I mean, some of the guys would adopt a kiddie while they were in reserve and that. and look after them and feed them and, you know, clothe them and that. We had, while we were in Pusan for about 10 days at one time, we had this little, we were sleeping in a railway carriage, and this little Korean lad latched on to us, and we used to call him Joe. Didn't know what else to call him. Well, it were nearly, they were nearly all Kim or Joe, and we used to call him Kim, Joe. And he couldn't speak English, and we couldn't speak Korean. Copy Joe. And that was, did you want coffee? And he used to make us coffee. And we used to like eggs, but the Korean eggs were only like little tiny things like bantam. But we used to have to draw him a picture of them, and he wouldn't understand what that, and draw him a hen, and then he knew what it was, and we'd give him some money, and he'd come back with these eggs, and all in a lovely straw bound, it was like a work of art and that. And we had him with us for 10 days, and then we had to move to this reinforcement camp, and we couldn't take him with us after when we left this reinforcement camp, so we passed him on to some others that were stopping. And we gave him all the spare stuff that we could. We gave him parts of uniforms and what bit of, because Korean money was nothing, you know, it was worthless and useless. And our own British baths wasn't a great deal of good. You dealt in script, American dollar script, or proper, you know, American dollars. But we went for a long while. We drew enough pay because there were nothing to buy, you know. So we got 5 days an hour in Tokyo. That was brilliant with that. You've heard the old expression, the army couldn't organise a piss up in a brewery, but they certainly had that organised. They would come up with your replacement, and they would say, this is your replacement, get your pack, you're on leave for 5 days. And they would take you with either whatever it were, a jeep or a wagon, down to the, you know, your B echelon, and then they would collect you from your B echelon and drive us down to Kimpo. Well, they call it airport, but then it was just a landing field. And there would be a massive, just a great big queue. Australians, New Zealanders, Canadians, Americans, all sorts, just waiting for a plane. And it was like a taxi service. One would come in, land, turn around, come down, they would fill it up, it would take off, another one would come in like that. And then they flew us to Tokyo, and they picked us up by bus from Tokyo Airport to a leaf camp at Ebisu, which is a district of Tokyo. And you walked in there, and in all your muck and everything, and the first thing you did, you went to armory and you handed whatever personal arms you had in, and then you took all your dirty clothes off and threw them in. There were showers, baths, wash basins, what you got yourself clean and shaved. Then you went up to the next little cubbyhole, and then you were issued with all clean clothes, new boots, clean socks, everything. Then you were paid off, and then they said, right, there's a meal waiting for you. And when you got in this dining hall, it was a fantastic dining hall. Lovely polished floors, tables with tablecloths and all the, you know, condiments on, knife, forks, spoons, and flowers on, Japanese waitresses, and we all plumped for steak. And while we were eating, they brought us like cloakroom tickets round, and they would pull a strip off a cloakroom ticket, and each ticket was a pint of Guinness, ice cold Guinness. And then you had a little lecture off the camp commandant, and the lecture went as such, you're here for 5 days. There's so many things you don't do. You don't attempt to touch any of the girls in this leave camp. If you do, you're on the plane, next plane back. Because Yeah, they give you a bed and that. Now, whether or not you used it was up to you. If you wanted to go down Tokyo and stay in a local hotel, you could go and stay in a local hotel if you wanted. And the other thing, your last day, you're back on the plane or else. And they warned you about the women being diseased and that. Apart from that, did your own things. Oh, and be off the streets at midnight. Now, the most of the patrols, military patrols that we came across were Australians. And the Australians didn't like the Yanks, and the Yanks didn't like the Australians. But the Brits, they weren't bothered about. They would say, oh, come on, lads, you know, get off. And they would usher you into the nearest bar at 12 o'clock. And you know, you'd stay if you didn't want to stay. You just wandered around up and down. Lots of people used to use very famous, well, it is to Korean veterans, the Ginza Beer Hall. And there were waitresses in there, but there were no hanky-panky with the waiters. They were polite, and you could ask them to come and sit with you and have your photograph taken, which they would, because there were somebody going around with a camera taking these photographs and that. But you didn't mess about with them or anything like that. And there were all sorts in that beer hall, Americans, you know, like all the UNs. I didn't see many of, when I was on leave, I never saw any Greeks. I never saw any French. I saw Belgian, Dutch, Canadian, and the Turks. But I never saw any of the, I once came across some Puerto Ricans or something like that. But the only way we knew they were Puerto Ricans, because they had a shoulder flash on that said Puerto Rico, because otherwise you would have thought they were Americans. You know, they were dressed completely Americans and armed Americans. But, and then if you like to say it, all good things came to an end. And we eventually, as you, the skins in the Skin and Dragoon Guards came over and replaced us, we came back to somewhere outside Busan again, I can't just remember. And we had to hand all the parkas in and the weapons, and then we were issued with new battle dresses and, you know, clothes and clean clothes and that. And we were on the Empire Georgic coming, not Empire Georgic. MV Georgic, Motor Vessel Georgic. And as we were waiting to go on, they came round issuing you with pieces of cardboard, and it had all these different things on. Butcher, baker, waiter, things like that. And we said, what's all these? And they said, oh, you'll find out. And the Georgic was all cabins, because it'd been an emigrant boat, and they were cabins, you know, twos, fours, sixes, threes, and things like that. And when we'd all got settled down, the announcement came over, those with a, shall we say, a blue card that says waiter, will you report to so-and-so place? And when you did, you said, you know, what's all the crack like? And they said, oh, this is your job coming back on the boat. And we said, a waiter? They said, yeah, a waiter. The people will come in and sit down and you'll serve them soup and that. We said, what, our own blokes? And he said, yeah. He says, we're not. Because it was a civilian steward that was saying that we would do this. And we said, we're not waiting on our own guys. So they didn't make no more to do, but they went and fetched an NCO. And the steward said to the NCO, tell these to do so and so. And because when the NCO said, you do it, you had to do it. But they came in and they sat down like a proper restaurant. And we used to have to wander up and down with a napkin on and a big jug of ice water. Would you like some ice water? And serve them the soup and take the plates away and the meals and that. And it wasn't a bad job afterwards, because when they'd finished all their meals, they always used to save the little tidbits for us, the waiters. And then we used to have to clear all the tablecloths, like at evening time, at tea time. And then relay them all for breakfast next day and that. It wasn't a bad job, really. Some of them were down in the bakery. I mean, they didn't actually, there would be one guy that did all the measuring and that, but they did all the donkey work. And it was the same, those that were in the butchers and department and vegetable departments. They kept the minimum of a civilian crew on, but we basically did the rest of it. But it were cushy because we did nothing coming back, apart from the work that you did like when you'd finished.
What date did you come back, do you think?
Christmas, we left December, sometime in December, because we had Christmas on the boat, coming back on the boat. We arrived in...
Christmas 51?
Christmas 51, yeah. Yeah, we Christmas 50 in Korea, we Christmas 51 on the boat, because we came back in January. We docked at Liverpool in January. And...
Were you glad to get out of Korea or sad about it?
I think mostly glad.
Have you ever been back?
Yes.
Has it changed much?
Yes. Yeah, I've been back. Look here, I've been back 3 times.
Has it changed for the better or the worse?
Oh, the better. I mean, nowadays you go to the centre of Seoul is an 8-lane highway and high-rise blocks as far as you could see, as far as you can see. There used to be two Bailey bridges over the River Han. Now there's about 19 different concrete and steel structures over the River Han. And the people, when you go back on a revisit, they are so grateful when they find out you're Korean veterans. They come up and they'll shake your hand in the street and or give you a little bow and things like that. I went back for 5 days, first of all. And then I went back for a fortnight the second time. And the second time, my wife went with me. And you got so many free days off, you know, because otherwise you were taken round to different places and that, you know, different museums and all sorts of things like that. But you got so many free days, so I said, oh, we'll make our own way down Seoul. And I said, we'll go get some money changed at the bank, because the hotel rate wasn't all that brilliant. So we wandered into Seoul, and it wasn't as easy as it sounds finding a bank, because you can't read the writing. So I stopped this guy, and I said, excuse me, do you speak English? You look a smart businessman with a... you know, an attaché case. I said, and he said, yes, I do a little. He said, can I help you? I said, yeah. I said, I'm looking for a bank. And he couldn't fathom out a bank. So we mimed, you know, to change some money and showed him some money and the passport. Oh, exchange, he said, exchange. And that's what they call them, exchanges or something. So he got hailed a taxi, got in with a taxi, with us, took us down to the bank, saw us to the right place, the money changed, came out with us again, and we said, how much do we owe you for the taxi? No, he said, you did to help my country. Shook hands with us both, said thank you very much, and off he went to work and that. We were in a bar one particular night, and they had some lovely little trays for nibbles, and the woman that owned the bar was very pleased because she got a load of Brits in and the beer were going down like there were no business, and she was coming round talking to people on the table because she could speak good English, and I just said to her,